group of people who came at slightly different times, but all in the earlier days of Ananda. And we're going to talk about what Ananda was like when we came, to give you a kind of a picture of the flow over the years. And so when I first came to Ananda, what Ananda looked like was a one-bedroom apartment in San Francisco. That was Swami's house, his flat at the time that he rented. And there was a small group. There are lots and lots. 13 minutes doesn't allow much time. But there was a small group that would come weekly, because he, after a short period of time, he started giving a weekly satsang. And a small group would come. When I say small, maybe 15, not more than 20, all crowded into his relatively smallish living room. And even from the very beginning, his satsangs would be very similar to what we have now. He would start with a prayer. There would be chanting. He would pass around a basket of various musical instruments for us to bang on. He taught me a simple rhythm on a guitar, on the drum, and so I was the drummer. And so each of us had a sense that we were contributing and not just receiving, and he was always that way. Then he would give a discourse, maybe 20 minutes or so, on some theme, and we would meditate together. And that was the basic format of the satsang. That regularity, other than that, he was teaching in a broad area around the Bay Area, and so nobody would have regular contact with him except at that satsang. Then that started in 1967. By the fall of 1967, I had become his assistant, quit my job, and worked with him there in the apartment. But in the summer of 1967, the land for the meditation retreat had already been acquired. So we came up several times, I think three or four times that I remember coming up. And the only thing that existed, the only structure that existed at Ananda when I first came up, was the water tower at the meditation retreat. It was pre-Charles Magic days, so it was looked a whole lot more like the slope going down to the Yuba River than it did like a beautiful garden. But we tried to build some housing there, and two or three failed attempts at domes. But it was really more bringing a presence to the land, and I'm not going to go into those stories. I've told them often. By the spring of 1968, Swami had realized that we weren't going to be able to, with the small group. So we were really, maybe the solid people by that time were a dozen people that would come up and back. And so with that small population, there were no real builders there. And he realized that we weren't going to be able to be successful in building. So he hired a crew. And in the summer of 68, they built two or three buildings. The only one of which is still standing is the little office dome there. So they built that little office dome. They built a temple. They built adjunct. All of these were domes. To it, which was the dining hall and kitchen. And then they built the little house that's Swami's. So the two, Swami's house, if you know where that is, that dome, and the office dome were the only things. We didn't have many activities other than the building and getting the roots established. Nobody basically stayed over the winter except for Benai and a couple of other very stalwart people who basically, it was like camping out in the snow for 5 months, you know, completely isolated and no other people around. And so it took a real hermit consciousness. Then about April, people started moving up there. So Swami and I both moved up in April of 1969. And that's when a lot of activities began happening at the meditation retreat. So there were classes every week. There would be, a Saturday retreat and Sunday service and a lot of activities. We were basically running the very primitive beginnings of what now is the expanding light. And so imagine the whole of Ananda being up there, and the activity was like the expanding light. Swami still traveled a great deal. He was still carrying on classes, and so he would leave during the week and come back on the weekends. And during that time, he was the single money earner for the whole operation. Very quickly, so we were up there in April, and very quickly it became obvious that we couldn't stay on that and build a community on that land. And so there was a search for land, and we found the property that is here didn't include the part that we're sitting on, but included the area with the market and kind of up toward, some of the hills there. It was about a third of the land that we have now. And so that was we took possession of that piece of land. The deed came through on July 4th, 1969, which is why we've decided to use that as the date for Ananda, as the community's birth time. You know, there we used to have anniversary from 1968, and then another anniversary in 69, and it got confusing. So we consolidated. So July 4th in 2019 will be our 50th anniversary. So we're getting up there. So I moved down to what we then called the farm right away. And at that time, word had gone out, and many people started coming. There were some who were former students of Swami, and there were many, many people who had just heard. It was in the midst of kind of the energy that was starting communes and really kind of the tail end of the hippie movement, or maybe not quite, maybe the the pigtail end of the hippie movement. So we were a wilder, hairier, much more diverse group at that time, because the real core Ananda values had not really been established yet. Swamiji, of course, held them, and there were some of us who had been with him for two or three or so years, but it was more as students. And so here we were living together, trying to establish those core values. And so there were debates going on, because many, many people who came because of heard that there was a community. In fact, I was one of three people who were kind of managing. I was the general manager because I had the history with Swami and was his assistant. But there were two other people that we were kind of co-managing. And we would have, during the summer of 69, as many as four or five cars arriving of people who had heard about Ananda and heard that there was free land, free housing, free food, and it sounded good to them. And so they would arrive, and we would send them off to the Yuba River. But there was quite a stream of that, and it was very diverse. But the government, so the core values of Ananda were being set. There was a group of us who were real meditators, and we were meditating. There was a group of us who were already Kriya Bonds and dedicated to Swami. And so we were the holders. Swamiji, above all, was absolutely the core who held all of these values. But there was a group that were in tune with him. And then beyond that, there were a large group of people who were not really in tune, but willing to try it out. And so if a person came and they seemed sincere, wanting to try out a spiritual life, wanting to get in tune, then they stayed. The others that were just kind of had no clue whatsoever what was going on here, they got shuffled off. So by the end of the summer, we probably had 35 people, maybe as many as 50 living, everybody camping. There were no structures except the market. That was the only building that existed for us at that time. And so everybody was camping. And we would have, to make decisions, we'd have kind of town hall meetings. We would gather on the lawn in front of the market, and we would just discuss whatever decisions that needed to be made. So along with establishing the tradition of meditation and attunement to Swamiji and hard work, because there were tremendous amounts of projects that needed to be done. At those early town hall meetings, we also established the tradition of arguing about whether there should be dogs in Ananda. which has continued until this time. And so it was really a time of consolidation and the forming of the core values. And then that continued, that process continued on until year by year it became more solid. As it became more solid, the people who came knew what we were doing and were much more in tune. And gradually over the years, it has grown into what you see now.
Ananda, it's a miracle, total. When I met Swami, I never saw anybody with the energy and the dynamism that he had. He just could take care of the world. He was so strong and so clear and yet so loving. When I met him, he introduced the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda, a way of life. When I lived in the world, it was really pathetic. I didn't do anything right. I managed to work. I bought a car, a Sprite, and drove around San Francisco, had a great time, all that. But inside, I was dying. And so when I met Swami, it was like, okay, this is what life is all about. And so I just followed him no matter what happened. I didn't understand spirituality, guru. I didn't understand anything. Hi, Jaya. Oh. So anyway, it was an amazing experience because I came from city life, didn't know anything about spirituality, but that was where I was going. So yes. 1967, I met Swami. That fall, I went up to Ananda, drove up with a friend. I found it, which was a miracle. And went up to the retreat and stood on the retreat land, and there was nothing there, absolutely nothing. There was a long board, a table, and on it were various kitchen utensils and a pot of honey with a lot of bees flying around. And I thought, this is really strange. But the vibration on the land was fabulous, and I just felt at home. So when I came back to the city, I spent a lot of time taking Swami's classes and also getting involved with Swami's satsangs. They were just wonderful. I was starting to type the cooperative communities, how to start them and why. I did the I don't know if you know an executive, IBM executive model typewriter. I don't think anybody knows what that is. Anyway, no computers. No, that one, that's a different one. That's the Selectric. Yeah. That came later. This one helped justify the book. So you type the book, and then you have to count so many lines, and before you know it, there you are. You have to retype it, adding in those extra spaces. That was really a deal. And so that took a while. And then that year, let's see, that was the year he was building buildings at the retreat. And, you know, that's what's so amazing. There was nothing, and all of a sudden there were all these buildings. And where did he get the money? Where did it happen? How he was so magnetic, and God, working through him, just drew energy. That kind of energy, money is energy. So anyway, so I moved up in 1970 and went to, actually the next year, drove up a lot with Swami to go on the weekends, be with him on the weekends, and attend the classes. And he'd come out in the morning and wake us all up with the drums. And Satya would do yoga postures, and we'd do fire ceremonies. And it was all very primitive. There was nothing there. People lived outside. I mean, you'd bring your sleeping bag and you'd sleep outside or on the deck. And we'd help in the kitchen. There was the common room that Jyotish talked about was also had a little kitchen. But there, I think they were building a kitchen at that time also. But we were, Alita Berger was the main kitchen person, just fabulous lady, but very strict about how you did things. And here we were, you know, outside on tables and things, and she wanted the tomatoes peeled and all the seeds taken out. That had to be no matter what. And so there we were. But it was quite an experience. One time, after we moved, I came up, drove up in my little, I had a Volkswagen bus at that time, or Beetle, rather, and took all my possessions, moved up in August of 70, and had been to the SRF convocation. That was their 50th year of master coming, and so I wanted to see that. I'd never been to SRF, and I wanted to see that, and it was a glorious affair. And Diamata at the end was sitting somewhere near the altar, I guess, and people could go up and, you know, she could give you a blessing. Well, I thought, why not, you know? So I went up and she looked at me and she says, "You young people are the ones who are going to build this work." And I thought that was really interesting that she would tune in on some level to what was happening, even though it wasn't her work, really, that was happening. So then I moved up, and I got up to the top, and I saw Binay. Thank God. Beautiful Binay. What a great soul he is. I said, "Binay, is there any place for me to live?" Because I hadn't even thought about that. I just had all my stuff. And Binay said, "Well, you're lucky. There's two structures. There's a teepee and there is a trailer." And I thought, oh, okay, well, I'm going to be really adventuresome. I'm going in the teepee. And Sadhana Devi probably built the outside of it. And so I spent the night there, but I didn't sleep very much. I was watching spiders running around and, you know, mice and rats and things, and that was a little over the top for me. So I went to the trailer, and the trailer was mine forever. That was what I took to Ayodhya when we moved there. But in the meantime, in 1970, we hunkered down and stayed there through the winter, some of us, and Lakshmi and her husband at that time was there and invited Swami down for a meal. Oh gosh, what is the name of that?
Manju.
Thank you. I knew somebody would help me here. She made fondue. She was living in a tent that was falling apart. It was raining. And this woman pulled together this meal that was fabulous for Swami because he loved fondue. So that was one of the little incidences. I mean, we walked around in bean boots and slickers, and it was an amazing experience. We had bean boots in the winter and Birkenstocks in the summer. And so anyway, we made it through the winter, and let me think now, where am I going with this? Swami helped, or I asked, I guess, if I could help with the finances. And so, yes, he was very happy to turn that over to me. And so I would also be going down to the village and helping Jyotish when I could and working with the finances. And anyway, I think I'm through.
Four more minutes.
let me see.
Tell about the monastery.
Okay, that's right. Thank you. So Swami in 1971, at the end of 71, decided that I think the farm needed some help. And he wanted people to go down to the farm and, you know, help Jyotish and create a big spiritual energy there. So he decided to create a monastery. And he asked a few of us to come to a meeting, and we all went to the meeting. And Haridas, Binay, Jaya, and Nitai wasn't there. Shivani, myself, Sadhana Devi, and Satya. Satya stayed at the meditation retreat, but we all moved. And the fun part of that was that Jaya had built a house for me that summer. And one of the funny parts of that building that house was that Jaya got the platform, and he had the frame of this eight-sided building. And he decided to raise it up so the roof wouldn't be so short. So he got some blocks and put them under one side, and the whole structure started falling off of it. And so I got involved, and the two of us finally got the building. You know, it was really scary. Anyway, at the end when it was all nicely built, this nice little cabin, Swami started the monastery. Well, there was no way I was going to just move up to the monastery. So I spent one night in my cabin and moved the next day. Took my lovely little trailer and went up to the Ayodhya, and it's plunked down right where my building is now. You can see the outline of my trailer in my building. And so that was easy and lovely. The monastery was fabulous. We had a great group of people there, and the women were up where Ayodhya is now. The men went down to the Crystal Hermitage and any new young people coming in would come to the monasteries. And it was good because that was really the only introduction system, so to speak, where they could learn how to meditate, be calm, quiet, and all of that, and meditate together as a group. And yet we went down to the farm every day and worked at the farm, did all the things that we needed to do, some in the garden, some in the office, and it was a wonderful experience. But without Swami's energy, you know, it wouldn't happen. So through Swami, and so we feel very blessed being here. People come now who don't know anything. They'll come to the Hermitage and just feel wow, the energy here is wonderful. What is this? So know that being here, doing whatever it is you're doing, is creating great magnetism. And I feel like the new generation coming up are just, they have their challenges. They're going to have their challenges.
When I first came to Ananda, I like to say Ananda came to me. I was living in Sacramento, and I attended a yoga class by Swami Kriyananda, fall of 1970. And it was an unusual thing. I was 20, 23 years old, and Swami walked out on the stage. He's in orange robes. He started talking about the most amazing things, the philosophy of yoga. In 10 minutes, I'm watching him thinking, when does the Swami get here? I'm 20. I'd never seen a Swami. I didn't know what. And after 10 minutes, I realized, he's the Swami. He's the Swami. So that's where I started. Before the end of the class, I made a trip to Ananda Retreat. It was this 11 November, 1970. And I saw Seva at her house. I think the house had just been completed. Maybe you'd spent the next night.
Close to the mic.
Next night, or it's too loud. The next night or the last night. Anyway, and also I saw the latest dome. The temple dome had burned down that year, as I understand, on the eve of 4th of July, 1970. And here was a structure made of wood struts with a pipe as the hub. And there were all these hexagons, pentagons, and it was all covered with burlap. And I walked in, and I could hear the echo, the characteristic sound of a dome. And it already sounded like a dome, but all there was burlap. Later, the inside and the outside of the burlap was sprayed with polyurethane foam, and that became a structure. So then I went back, and I was telling Swami that I had been to Ananda, and he looked at me, and he said, how did you like it? And what I saw in him, the strange experience, it was as though all the work that he'd done, he was holding out for me, and he said, how did you like it? And he was waiting for my judgment or my whatever, my approval. It was it's quite an experience for me. And I realized, this was toward the end of the class, all the things that he'd talked about, all the spiritual practices that he was talking about, he was doing. He was an example of that. And I was deeply impressed. And I thought, that's what I want to do. That's very important. That's a feedback of what he's talking about that I can't, you know, that's undeniable. That's good stuff. I was working as an engineer in those days. And so I come up to visit. And I decided to come and live at Ananda. And I moved to Ananda in December 1973. I came on the eve of the all-day meditation. It was cold. I slept in my car, and I had made arrangements. I had a car that could do that. Got up in the morning. There was ice on the inside of the window, and went in the temple. And the temple by that time was completed. And there were these benches in the temple, freestanding benches with padding on the top. They were just the right height to sit on. But they seated three people maybe. So all day meditation, you want to sit still. But not everybody sits still. So if three people sitting on the bench, and I'm trying to sit as still as I can. It was a miserable experience. And And then, but after that all-day meditation, the rest of the Christmas season was, I was feeling really, really good. It was, I don't know, maybe some kind of penance or something that I paid in sitting there trying to meditate when 8 hours. But there was no, there wasn't enough room for all the guests. And Swami had moved to the monastery. He had built another dome at Ayodhya. And the dome that he had there was that night and for a couple of nights for guests. And we all slept in sleeping bags on the floor of Swami's dome. There was a little girl who was snoring, the littlest girl, you know, and she was making quite a ruckus. We had a Christmas celebration. Swami read P.G. Woodhouse. We had gift exchange. It was an all in the common dome. There was a Christmas tree. Everybody was there, and it was a warm community feeling you could just about cut with a knife. It was so warm and inclusive. But later, a few days later, we had a heavy snow. And there was a trail that went from the top of the hill down to the meadow. And people walking on that trail had created kind of a trough. Looked a little like a bobsled run. And Vijay Gerard had skis and boots. And we got him out at night under a full moon. And this just too good to be true. So I could ski, you know, and I got my turn. And I started down the hill. And it's very hard to turn in, you know, in a bobsled run. But I was in the part where it was going down the hill. I was accelerating. I managed to turn, and I got going off to the side in the snow that wasn't packed or anything. But I was going pretty fast. And then I got in the trees. It's really dark at night under the trees. And I'm really moving. And I'm realizing this is not a good situation. I'm going along with my hand. I'm expecting to hit something any minute. Luckily, I didn't hit anything. But it's a great story. I was terrified suddenly. I finally got my own place. It was a house that's now called Gratitude. It was a nine-sided house. And it was one that Jaya built in that style that was great. And I lived there. And I wanted to tell you that the meditation retreat was thick manzanita. There were just trails. You know, there were trails that were cut through the manzanita. Otherwise, everything was manzanita. One night after dinner, I had failed to provide myself with a flashlight to get home. It was raining. Del rain means clouds. It's totally black. And I don't know where I'm going, you know, and feeling around in manzanita isn't a satisfactory plan. But there was lightning. Wow! All the sky blasts open with all this light, and I could see, you know, and then I'd see the trail and I'd wander along. And then it would get dark again. Another lightning. Finally, I got back to where I was supposed to be. But that was a great story. So then I got recruited to be in Ananda Planning. I had engineering background. They said, oh, good, you can draw the maps. And Sam Dardick and Anandi. And a man named Sevananda, and we were in the farmhouse. The farmhouse itself is a story because it doesn't exist here anymore, but it was here then. It was a two-story building. Sam Dardick came with his family, and he lived upstairs. Downstairs, the living room was our office, and I had a drawing board, and we were working with Sam's guidance to create the first master plan. So we just had a master plan approved for 25 years, and we started the master plan process in those days My maps are dated 1975. And on the map, dated 1975, it shows a temple. And the temple is right over there. Not everything on the map got built according to the map. We had to turn in something. And so that was a great experience doing the master plan. We were married. Saraswati and I knew each other before we came to Ananda. And Swami Kriyananda agreed to marry us in the temple. We were married 3 January 1976. And on the way into the temple, I walked in with Swami Kriyananda. He told me he had a spiritual name for me, and it was Ganesha. Ganesha, meant God of wisdom. We were married in the temple, and Maitri, who may be here, maybe not, she lives in the community still. Maitri was a high school student at the time, and she played her flute as part of, I think we were walking in. And the experience was so, so sweet. I think if it had been one centimeter sweeter, I would have just dissolved in the carpet. It just would have been a puddle of, I don't know what. But it was very sweet. So we were married, and Saraswati moved to the house that I had, and she made it beautiful. We had dinner parties there. We have pictures from those days. The house was really, really nice when she moved. And on the occasion of her moving in, I built an outhouse. The house, it was served with more primitive facilities before that. Then I got a job building flour mills for Al Anderson in the barn that used to be down where the community center is now. And the barn itself is a story. The barn was also the headquarters for Mukhtan's bee business, Ananda Apiaries, I think he called it. So walking into the barn was an exercise in courage, stillness, centeredness, because there were thousands of bees. The atmosphere was 100% bees. And I had to walk in, turn to the right, walk up the stairs. I turned toward the front of the barn, and I had a room there where I built flour mills. I had, put the flour mills together. And upstairs, toward the back of the barn, was the office of Biasa. And Biasa had a laboratory, a magic room there, where he repaired stuff, he built stuff, and the barn itself is something I wanted to talk about. We had agricultural equipment, shipping, and the bees. And that's all there's time for today.
Namaste. Hello, everyone. I'm Nayaswami Savitri. And I suppose everybody in this room has a date in their life that they can remember, which was one of the most important dates, probably two or three of them. But for me, it was July the 17th, 1975, which is the day I arrived at Ananda. Back up just a little bit, I was living in Texas, and I found a copy of the Autobiography of a Yogi in 1968, interestingly enough, about the time Ananda was starting, but I had never heard of Ananda and didn't for a number of years. It took me a while to find out about Ananda, but I was very interested in communities. I was living in a community, a very small sort of hippie commune out near Austin, Texas, when I found out about Ananda. There was a little very small, first of all, I found the spiritual communities guide that the Sufis had put out in about 1970. And about 71, I found a little tiny ad in the communities magazine that had just started being put out that Ananda, the thing I read in the communities guide said Ananda is a place where everyone who lives there follows the teachings of Yogananda. And I thought, well, that's great, because I already loved Yogananda and I was interested in community, so the things seemed to go together. I thought, I'll go there, I'll visit there. But meanwhile, I was living in this place called the Peaceable Kingdom, which was very much a hippie commune, and just a few of us there, 15 or so of us, but it was great. I learned to do organic gardening and quilting and various things like that. We were way ahead of our times there. We had a solar shower and we had windmills, and we were doing our thing. But it was not spiritually based, and I was beginning to long for that. So the Communities magazine had a little two-line ad in it, and I know Prakash put it in there, saying, apprentice program, come one, come all, $55 a month. And later on, when I was telling some friends about this apprentice program I had gone to at Ananda Village and paid $55 for being there, they said, let me get this straight. You paid them to work there? And I said, well, no, they gave me a place to stay and food and all of that. And said, but you still paid them to let you be there. And I said, yeah. She said, that's a great idea. She said, let's do that here. This was at the community. So we started our own apprentice program, too, and got people to pay us to come and live and work. So this was an interesting idea that began to take hold and goes on to this day, I imagine, in some form or another. But anyway, the important date I was talking about, July the 17th, 1975, I flew from Texas to Sacramento, and Parvati picked me up at a little bus station in Grass Valley, which is how you got there in those days, and drove me out here and dropped me off. And dropped me off is the word. There was really nothing here to speak of. Dropped me off down here off of Tyler Foot Road at a little goat shed, which is where Shivani was living. And she said, stay here. Stay. I had a duffel bag with my tent, and she said, stay. Somebody will come and help you soon. Well, I waited and waited, and no one was showing up. And the other thing was so interesting is they had told me, I had corresponded with Prakash a little bit about this apprentice program. What will I need to bring? He said, well, you can bring a little tent, but it doesn't rain in the summer, so no problem. It was pouring. And I have this very insufficient pup tent that I needed to put up somewhere. And so Kirtani came over from the garden. I knew I was going to be working in the garden. And that was the first time I met her, and she welcomed me very sweetly. And she said, someone will be here, Govinda, to help you put up your tent. And my first night was in a little, very not rainproof tent, and I was soaked to the bone by the next morning. Got up, the sun was shining, it was beautiful, and I found some clothesline and put everything I had and gotten wet up to dry. And so that was my first night at Ananda. But it was a very sweet experience for me, because that night, before I got into my very wet tent, Shivani, Prakash, and Kirtani had me over for a little dinner at Shivani's goat shed, which Shivani, in typical Shivani manner, had me cook the dinner. I was initiated immediately. Her excuse was, she said, I've just recently been married, and I don't know what it means to be a householder, and I don't know how to cook, and my husband doesn't like this a bit. And, she went on with this. She said, can you cook? And I said, yeah, I think so. And she said, okay, well, will you make dinner? So we had a little dinner, but it was so sweet, because the four of us were sitting there talking about Lahiri Mahashaya and gurus and all this wonderful stuff, because I'd been living alone as a devotee in Texas for a number of years, and I'd never even seen another devotee, a disciple of Master. I was just thrilled. I would have slept in 1,000 wet tents to have that experience of being there with my fellow disciples. I didn't even know what a disciple was, but I knew I was one, and I was so happy to be here. I knew from the minute I arrived that this would be my home. And that was 1975. I took Kriya that end of spiritual renewal week. I stayed for 2 months here. I'll tell you another funny, quick story. My first Sunday here, Sunday came around, and I said, what do you do here on Sunday? There was not a lot of communication going on in those years. And they said, well, you go up to the meditation retreat that Swami will be giving Sunday service. And I said, well, how do I get there? And they said, well, you just walk out on Tyler Foot Road and you wait for a ride. I said, okay. And so I walked out on Tyler Foot Road and you know, people were passing me by, and I wasn't much of a hitchhiker. I'd actually never done it before. But I thought, you know, if I'm going to get anywhere, I wasn't even sure where I was going. I was told to go left, so I stuck out my thumb. And this very strange man came and pulled up, and I said, hi, and I'm from Ananda, and I want to go to Sunday service. And he went, okay, well, get in. And he drove me up and dropped me off at Jackass Flat Road, which wasn't named that then. It was named nothing, Dirt Road. And he said, go up that road, you'll get there. I thought, oh, boy. So he dropped me out. So I started walking along this dirt road. It's summer. It's very hot. I don't even know where I'm going. So I stopped in the shade, and I was told to be up here, up there for a fire ceremony. I'm thinking, fire, oh, so hot, I gotta go to a fire ceremony. I wasn't sure whether I was gonna be asked to take off my shoes and walk through the fire. But I was already walking through the fire by walking across the diggings there in July Sunday. But nevertheless, somebody finally came along and picked me up. I was too early for the big crowd of people coming for the Sunday service because not that many people went to the fire ceremony. Swami wasn't leading it then. But I got there. I went to the fire ceremony. I think Vijay led it. And there were like 3.2 people there. But we all threw rice and all these things, which I knew nothing about. But it was fun. And then there was Swami. And I'd never met Swami before. And I'd heard of him. But I had wondered what he was going to be like. And, oh, it was so wonderful to see him. He immediately, I mean, he didn't know me from Adam, but his energy embraced me. And I remember I didn't know anything about who Swami was in relation to Master, and was Swami considered to be the guru here, or what was that? I didn't know any of that stuff. And immediately he picked up on my thought, as he always did, and he was giving a sweet talk about I don't know what, but anyway, right in the middle of the talk, he basically stopped and looked at me, and he said, I'm not the guru here. Paramahansa Yogananda is the guru here. But if you're a disciple of Yogananda, I've been a disciple a long time, maybe I can be of help to you. I just melted. I said, oh boy, this is so... Because if he had said, I am the guru here, bow me if I... By the way, I want all your money, which I didn't have any of. I would have been very put off. But it was so... I was so sweetly embraced by his energy from that moment forward, and I never really looked back at all. It took me 3 years to move here because I had a whole life back in Texas. I had to go back and wrap it up, and I came back 2 more times. I came back the next summer. So I was in a position that not many people have been in, I don't think, in that I first saw Ananda in 75, in July of 75. I came back for Spiritual Renewal Week in August of 76 and stayed with Kirtani and Purushottama. I had made a number of friends here so I could have a place to stay. But between 75 and 76, do you remember what happened? It burned down. I came to a beautiful community with beauty everywhere, and I went away and I came back to a community made out of ashes. And I was so, I wrote or called and said, maybe I shouldn't come. And I said, oh, yeah, come. Honestly, I think if I hadn't known there had been a fire, I might not have known there had been a fire because everybody had already shifted around and people had moved to the meditation retreat and people had moved off the land in various places. And everybody was just carrying on in the sweetest spirit. I think that above almost anything let me know that this was a place I needed to be here because the people, I mean, Swami was amazing, but the people who lived here were so incredible. And I'm going to stop now, but I know a lot of people probably wanted to hear stories about, you know, bad roads and bad, no plumbing and outhouses. And barely, one of my thrilling experiences, the first time I dug my own outhouse hole by myself, as I was doing that, I remember thinking, you know, I'm a college graduate. What am I doing? And then I realized, you know, it's necessary. We need an outhouse. It's needed. It's one of those things you need if you don't have plumbing. So just keep doing it. So I just kept doing it and doing. Eventually it was done. So there have been many, many, many happy years. I couldn't say how grateful I am to have found Ananda and spent, in 2 weeks, my 42nd anniversary of having arrived at Ananda will come around. And I always celebrate that day, the 17th of July, as the most important day, really, in my life. Interestingly enough, when I moved here, Bag and Baggage, in 1978, I happened to look at the calendar to see what day is it I'm arriving here, really going to be able to live in here. Guess what day it was? July the 17th. Exactly 3 years later, Divine Mother Master guided me so sweetly into this haven. I'll never be able to be grateful enough for that, so thank you.
For those who don't know me, my name is Naya Swami Sudarshan, and I came in May of 1974 first to visit, and I came to, it must have been a How to Meditate weekend, I'm not sure. For those of you who know Preeta Reed, she came for that same program. There are about seven or eight of us. And so we celebrate our anniversary, even though I don't remember the exact day, unlike Sadhguru, but it was about May of 74. Right about that time, Swami was writing The Path. And I think it was late 74 and early 75. Is that about right, Davey? And Swami had satsangs every Wednesday. I forgot to mention that I came for that weekend, and I really enjoyed it. It just felt wonderful here. It felt like there was a breeze of blessings. And you know, it was almost, I think I even did an experiment. I went down to Tyrefoot Road, and when there were no cars coming, there were a lot less cars coming along in those days. I could walk out into the road, which was off the Ananda boundary, and the breeze of blessings that was flowing through my cells would diminish. And then I could walk onto the Ananda land, and the breeze of blessings that was flowing through my cells would increase. It was just absolutely wonderful, and I didn't quite understand what was going on. Anyway, getting back to, I think, the satsangs. Swami had a satsang every Wednesday, and he would read the latest chapter of The Path. Well, I was part of the Ananda Sacramento Center, the Ananda Sacramento Meditation Group, and we really meditated. We took meditation group seriously, but we also came up here a lot. And so we would come up for Sunday services, and we would come up for those Wednesday night satsangs. So after work, we'd all carpool together, drive up from Sacramento, come to Swami's dome and listen to him read the path. And I'm afraid we Sacramentoites were not a great deal of help to Swami. Swami wanted feedback about what he had written, and we were all too awe-inspired just in his presence to really say very much. I think we tried to say some things, but anyway, that was wonderful, wonderful satsang at that time. I'm going to remember the next thing here. So Swami not only did those satsangs, but he did monks' satsangs. He did nuns' satsangs. When he would usually give a class on Saturday. When Spiritual Renewal Week came along, he did every class at Spiritual Renewal Week. And then for the evening, he put on an evening program, a musical program, playing his guitar. He was absolutely amazing, the amount of energy that he put out, and fresh as a daisy, just very, very happy. One of the things also that he did, and he didn't do this for very long, he wasn't able to keep this up, but one thing that he did was he had interviews, and Shivani, I believe, was the one who set up the interviews after Sunday service, and so they'd schedule three or four or five of them for him, maybe a half an hour at a time, something like that. And I was talking with Asha, I think, one time. And I said to Asha, well, should I go get an interview? And she said, oh, yes. He's the spiritual doctor, and you need to go get your checkup, your spiritual checkup. And so I thought, well, okay. I didn't think I had too many questions, but I decided to go get my spiritual checkup from Swami. So Swami greeted me. We sat down. I think we sat down in his house, the dome house that I think Jyotish was mentioning that's up at the meditation retreat right now. And he introduced himself. We had actually talked with each other before, but this was the first time we'd really had a spiritual conference. And I said, I sort of blurted out something about, well, Swami, how am I doing spiritually? And he said something like, well, let's see. Now imagine we're sitting across from each other. I thought enough that he wanted to look sort of into me, I guess, something like that. And so I tried to hold his eyes, you know, look directly into his eyes, and let him read me, so to speak. Well, so he looked in my eyes, and he went, And then he looked at one point, it was like he looked at a different angle slightly, and he went, And then at another point, he said, This went on for a little while. And finally he said, okay, well, what can I do for you? And then at that point, I figured out something to ask about my spiritual life and so forth. But it was a somewhat humbling experience. But I like to think that an awful lot of those things that he saw got fixed up over the years. I can feel that that was true. The standard salary, if you want to call it that, at Ananda Village in those days, we'll fast forward a little bit, and in February of 76, I actually moved here from Sacramento. And by that time, I knew an awful lot of people because I'd been sort of commuting. In fact, I used to say, I figured I might as well move to Ananda, then I'd save gas money. So anyway, in February of 76, I moved here. I was saying the salary was room and board and $50 a month. And for those of you who may not be thinking about what $50 was worth in 1976, it's probably more like about $200 a month now. But that's still not a whole lot. And so people couldn't afford a car, largely. And many, many people couldn't afford a car. And that was kind of good because the roads weren't very good. There were no paved roads at Ananda. Tigerfoot Road was paved. It was great. But and gravel was kind of expensive. It was expensive to hire a dump truck and bring gravel in. So we put in a new road. Ayodhya Way wasn't in. Okay, the way to drive over to Ayodhya. Okay, and I think I remember that it did get bulldozed and it put in, but I don't think we had the money to put gravel on it. And so in the wintertime, especially over on the south side of it, it all soaked up with water, and so it used to eat cars. I remember I had a 54 Willys utility wagon. For those of you who know what a Willys is, it's a four-wheel drive. It was one of two four-wheel drives in the community. And so I remember driving around in the wintertime, and as some people have mentioned, winters were longer, colder, and there was more snow, generally. Than they've been recently. And so I remember I couldn't drive from one side of Ananda to another without seeing a car kind of at an odd angle on the side of the road and a hopeful person. I also had a winch on the front of the thing. And so if I couldn't pull them out with the four-wheel drive, I winched them out. And so it was always a great adventure. There were some daredevils in the community who felt that if they went really, really fast, they could get through the mud puddle and come out on the other side. And sometimes that worked. But what we did, Ananta's here, we had, there was also the old three-cylinder tractor that the garden had, the three-cylinder Ford tractor. So between the tractor and me and Shakti, which was the other four-wheel drive in the community, we realized that it was probably good to set up a counter-incentive system for people. The first pullout in the season was $5. The second pullout in the season was $10. The third pullout in the season was $20. Now, $20 was a lot of money. Okay. That actually worked pretty well to help people think a little bit more before they gunned it. So, so people, as Jyotish mentioned, people lived at the farm. We called this area, or the area around on Tyrefit Road, the farm. And most of the population lived at the farm because of an agreement with the Bald Mountain Association that we would move the population here. But all the infrastructure was at the meditation retreat, the temple. It was the only temple we had. And so Sunday morning came along. Savitri mentioned this a little bit. And people would walk because there was no way to walk over here. Well, there was actually a trail. But they walk out Sages Road from Ayodhya all that way, if you remember how far that is, and even in the snow, and congregate out on Tigerfoot Road. And I would pull up with, and Benny Card, I would pull up with the Willys, and it had a big open back. It was kind of like a small delivery van. And we'd open up the back, and everybody would pile in. Ananda, you probably remember this, and others. And I don't know how many people we got in there. You know, 10? You know, something like that. Had a four-cylinder engine. It slowly ground up the hill. It had 12 speeds forward and 4 reverse, you know, with all of its different gearing. I remember, Krishnadas, how am I doing?
Two more minutes,
okay. I remember a wonderful experience. Swami also was the only Kriyacharya. And so he gave Kriya interviews. And I knew this was coming up, and I had very carefully made sure that I'd been doing Hongsa for the proper amount of time and the Om technique for the proper amount of time so that I could take Kriya Yoga initiation. So I had my name on the list for this Kriya interview. And there was a young lady there. And Swami interviewed her. We were doing it all in a group, kind of a little circle. And he said, well, how long have you been doing Hong Sa? And she was applying to take Kriya. And I think the Kriya was going to be in that few days. And she said, I learned it this weekend. And he said, how long have you been doing Om? Oh, I don't know Om yet. Okay. And Swami very dutifully went through all the requirements for taking Kriya. And you could see the ladies, you know, this young lady's, you know, spirit just slowly diminishing, you know, realizing that she was asking for something that wasn't quite appropriate. And at the end, Swami disposed of all the requirements, and then he looked her right in the eye and he said, but I feel that Divine Mother wants you to have Kriya now. Swami always went by what he felt, what Divine Mother seemed to be telling him. I got one minute, probably. Fast forward a little while, and we had an India fair right out here in the meadow. Kalyani, who organized the India fair, was a person whose ambitions knew no bounds, and she had a nice talk with somebody at Circus in Reno, and convinced them to bring two elephants here to Ananda. I was the storyteller and I was all in brown body paint with dhoti, which I didn't know how to wrap. We made a paper mache mountain where I was supposed to sit in front of and talk. At one point, I got up from my mountain because I didn't have any takers, partly because it was a hot day and people were going swimming down at Lotus Way. I was standing next to one of the elephants by this time, and I asked the keeper, or the trainer, I said, "Do the elephants want to go for a swim?" And he said, "Well, we have to be very careful. We want to be sure that they're okay." Well, the next thing I knew, I think I had to walk back somewhere. Next thing I knew, the elephants were down in the pond. And the elephant, I watched from up there. I didn't take, I'm eternally ungrateful to myself. I didn't take off my costume and go down there and go swimming too. But the elephants were standing, you know, this high in the water to an elephant. And and they would lower their head. Somebody would clamber up on their head. The elephant obviously knew to raise its head. The person would stand on top of its head and dive into the water. And they did that over and over again. It was just great fun.
I first found out about Ananda in 1973. I was an SRF member at the time, and I was learning how to meditate from a paper. And I think I need a little help. And so Divine Mother sent me some help in the form of Swami Kriyananda's book, Your Sun Sign as a Spiritual Guide. I was very interested in astrology at the time, and I was living in San Francisco. And there was, at that time, one metaphysical bookstore. And I went there, and I was looking in the astrology books, and I found this book by Swami Kriyananda. And I thought, this is nice. I bought it. And I was amazed. Back in that day, you would say, you know, my mind was blown by this book, because being a Gemini, you know, think all the bad things there are about being Gemini. That's what you read in the book. Oh, you're flaky, or this, or that. You can't concentrate. And there was never really any hope for you. Why wasn't I a Sagittarius, for crying out loud? So anyway, Swami gives us hope in that book. These are the things that you can do if you're a Gemini, if you're a Scorpio. These are the things that can help you grow spiritually if you are this sun sign. And I thought, wow, this is what I've been looking for. And I flipped it over, read the back, learned about Ananda. So I did travel up to Ananda in the summer of 1973 for Spiritual Renewal Week. And I knew that I would be coming back. So I worked towards that goal. And I went back to my hometown in Moline, Illinois, and in the winter of 1974. And I did various jobs in, you know, negative 20 degree weather. Some of these were outside jobs to save some money to come to Ananda. And I had prearranged with Shivani. You guys have heard that name, Shivani. If you don't know her, Ms. Powerhouse. She was in charge of the now famous 1975 apprentice program. But she talked me into coming early, because she needed help in the garden. And I said, well, great, I'll come early. And so I arranged to come early, and I got a ride from Moline, Illinois to Auburn, California. And I got out of the car, and it was sunny. It was 60 degrees. I had come from, you know, negative 20. I thought, it's spring here. Yes, it's California. And I hitchhiked to Ananda. Within 2 days, it was pouring rain. It was snowing. There was mud to tromp through, and I didn't have the bean boots yet. I was fairly ill-prepared. But I did have a little camper that had been on the back of a truck that I co-owned with some people, and I got the camper, plopped it down over that way, in a place we call, it's near the Lalan and Nityananda's house. We called it Baby Lane later. That was after people started having babies in that area. Anyway, it was cold. And I think back, I thought, how did I heat that place? I must have just turned on the stove to stay warm. But anyway, I worked in the garden, and I did my duty, and it was a difficult time. And nobody was here yet, really. The apprentice program hadn't started. So anyway, then everybody started showing up, and it was just an amazing time, that apprentice program. Prakash was in charge of it, and many, many, many great souls came through there. Some of those great souls stayed. Some of those great souls left and took what they learned and went on with it. But it was a crazy time. It was an inspiring time. It was a wild time. It was a deep time. So I wanted to talk about not just my own experiences, but three different qualities that I felt when I first came to Ananda. The first quality, energy and adventure. you know, you couldn't do anything here if you didn't have energy. That was just, there wasn't anything here. So you really just had to put forth your energy and learn how to do it. It was a big lesson if you didn't know how to do it yet. But we learned, and, you know, because there was, as you have heard, a lot of people started out by camping. By the time I got there, I called it the early teenage years of Ananda. I had my little camper. There was teepees, there was trailers, so it wasn't just camping out on the ground. But there weren't a lot of other amenities, and, you know, some fun stories around taking showers in the community shower house, which was up on the hill, kind of on the way to, if you know where Benai lives, back that way. And the water was pond water. It was hooked up to pond water. And as the summer got hotter and the pond went down, you know, it got... At that time, I had a little bit blonder hair, and I would notice, what's this red tint in my hair? And it was, you know, from the gunk in the pond. What in the wintertime turned out to be the red mud, you know. And there was a little, not a little, every so often there was this big toad like this that liked to come in because it was wet and it was cool in there, kind of, and he would stay in the corner. And you would just kind of take your shower. But you know what? It was fun. And it sure makes for some really good stories now. The other part of that, the adventure part that I want to talk about, you better have been prepared for adventure because you didn't have any money and you had to make it somehow. And but it was great. We didn't have a lot of needs. Most of us didn't have cars. We would share cars. We would, you know, go to town with somebody to do our laundry. And if you went to the laundromat by Swenson's ice cream parlor, you could go out for a treat. You know, that was a big deal, going out for your ice cream cone. But, well, in the winter of 1975, there was this big deal where we were going to make a lot of money. And because it cost $1,000 to become a member at that time, membership price, $1,000, who had that money? You know, $50 a month. We were happy on that, but we wanted to pay our membership. So there was a tree planting crew that went out to Oregon, and somehow a bunch of guys, Jai was part of it, Jai and Sadhana, and somehow I talked myself in to being the cook, and I honestly didn't know how to cook at that time. But I thought, well, you know, I'll learn on the job, which I did, I guess. But we went up to outside of Eugene, Oregon. It was a campground. For crying out loud, we stayed there all winter in a campground, and we bought Quonset hut tents, army tents. The kitchen was a Quonset hut. We had to buy the stove, the sink, everything that you have to cook with and use, we bought. But it was fun. It was so much fun. Sometimes. Then it started raining and raining and raining, and the guys couldn't plant. And the contract was a bad contract, and it was very steep and with a lot of slash. And many days, the guys couldn't work. And then it was raining and raining. One night, I lived in the back. We had a tent that was also used as a temple. And I must have had about that much space with a little curtain across it to sleep. And someone came and knock, knock, knock. Get up, get up, get up. We have to move the tent. The river is rising. That's what we did. We got up and we moved the tent. We moved it farther up and then we were okay. But that was a pretty good adventure story. We didn't make our $1,000. We had to, you know, just like everything, pay it off. Come on, you can do it. So we did. The next quality I wanted to talk about is discipline. You can have energy. Energy without discipline doesn't get you very far. And a lot of us had a lot of energy, but a lot of us didn't have a lot of discipline in those early years. And my teacher of discipline and many other people's teacher of discipline was our gardening instructor, Honnell Cassidy. I don't have a lot of time, so I can't tell you a lot about him, but just think of he was a short, slight man, ramrod straight, spine like this, and he was a professional man. He was a professional gardener. He was a professional photographer. He was a professional singer. And he was a disciplinarian, and that's what we needed at that time, for sure. You know, we had all these young people who were here and just wanting to learn things and had energy, But maybe we didn't show up for work when we were supposed to, and boy, you had better if you were working under him or you were going to get the treatment. He used to illustrate his talks to us and his discipline to us and his scolding to us with various little stories and jokes. And there was one called The Horse's Complaint.
Yes.
And The Horse's Complaint, this was somebody who was like way out of it, who wasn't showing up, who would lean on their hoe or just walk off at break time and not come back, go back and take a nap. So he says, let me tell you about The Horse's Complaint. Well, gradually, eventually we heard this story many times because there was a lot of people who had The Horse's Complaint. He says, this is how it goes. There was a man, he was selling a horse, and a guy came to buy the horse, and he says, let's take it out. I want to see how this horse runs. And the guy's selling it says, okay, sure. So they take the horse out away from the barn. And the guy who wants to buy the horse slaps the horse on the rump, and the horse takes off running, runs to the barn, and slams right into the barn. And the guy says, what? You're trying to sell me a blind horse? And the guy says, he ain't blind. He just don't give a damn. So there were a number of us who had to learn that lesson of giving a damn and showing up when it was time to show up. And he taught us so much about gardening. He is the reason that we have a garden today and that Ananta and Maria are back doing it. And I learned some of my best lessons from him, how to coil a hose, to this day, I cannot use a hose and just leave it lie there. I have to coil it up. That's how it's done. And I was in charge of the watering for one summer. How am I doing? Going down? Oh, okay. I let a whole huge two rows of transplanted lettuce die because I didn't come back. I thought it was going to be okay. I didn't come back to water. And I felt so horrible about that. That was one of my biggest lessons. And he just looked at me. He didn't have to say anything. He didn't have to do the horse's complaint. He didn't have to say anything. Boom. So I got my discipline from Hanno. Finally, the last thing, quality I want to talk about is just the incredible divine blessings flowing through Swamiji, Master flowing through Swamiji. And for those who could see, for those who could hear, for those whose hearts were open, could bring those blessings in, get the teachings, bring them into their lives. But I have to say I was kind of out of it. I was kind of clueless when I first came. I came more for community than I came for the teachings. And I remember it was my first Easter here, and I was going to take a break. It was my first break from the garden. I'm going to go back to San Francisco. I wasn't going to be bad. I was just going to go visit some friends. And I told Shivani, I said, I'm going. I'll be gone. And she looked at me, and she just burrowed her eyes through me and said, you are crazy. And I was offended. And I thought, I'm not going to do anything bad. I'm just going to visit my friends. But I was leaving at Easter. What happens at Easter? I mean, all that vibration I was missing. And there's my beeper. And that was a huge lesson to me. So gradually, Divine Mother just blessed me by putting me here and putting me with other people who are more advanced than I was and who could teach me things. But Swami's blessings and vibrations, I was at least open to. That's what we're asked to be, is to be open to those blessings. And it's been my blessing for 42 years to still be here. So,
well, it's interesting what Ridaya just said about coming more for community than for the teachings. When I discovered Master, I was actually living in Japan, and talk about when the yearning of the disciple is great enough, the guru will come. Because I was living in Japan, not the Japanese equivalent of New York City. I wasn't in Tokyo. I wasn't in Osaka. I was living in, you'd have to consider it, some absolute boondocks in West Virginia. I mean, a coal town that's dying. I lived in that kind of a town within Japan, way, way out in the country. Closer. Boy, okay. But somehow Autobiography of a Yogi came into my hands, and I did what I think so many of us in this room did. I sat and I read it. I'm not sure I slept at any point during those 2 days, but it galvanized me. It changed. This is it. This is what I've been wanting to do. And then I looked out at the cherry blossom trees and the dirt road in front of my house, the Buddhist cemetery that was right behind my house, and I thought, what am I going to do about this? The fact that there was an organization in Southern California that had been founded by Yogananda, right over my head. Had no, just never, never, ever registered. So I carried on with my duties in Japan, but along came two friends who had been away, and they hadn't read Autobiography of a Yogi, but they were desperately seeking spiritual community. They had gotten a hold of the many aforementioned times spiritual community guide, which seemed to be floating worldwide at that time. Who knows how it got dispersed. They got a hold of one, and the three of us were trapped on an island by a typhoon at the end of a summer camp we'd been doing, teaching English. And they spent their time writing letters all over the world to spiritual communities. Two communities answered them. One of them was Ananda, which is miraculous when one thinks back to 1976. This is. And I wish I knew who answered it, is all I can say. But I've also heard stories about people finding it from a blurb on an Ananda incense package. So the guru comes in many, many ways. So they were very excited about, we're going to move. We're going to move to this spiritual community. It's new. We're very excited about it. No mention of Yogananda or Master. But my problem was this. I deeply mistrusted groups of any kind. When I was 16, my local Methodist church decided that the way that they were going to train their upcoming youth leaders was to take advantage of a psychological training technique then very popular called encounter groups. And yes, groans among the elders in the room. So the idea was basically you were going to be put into a room for about 48 hours, and the idea was you were supposed to be, you let your hair down, you were sleepless, and you were going to help knock the barnacles off of everyone else in the group by being brutally honest in the moment as much as possible. And then that was going to traumatize the other person. But that breaking down process would ultimately emerge in this newly constructed person. I was 16. They were 17. It was a horrendous event. And from then I went on to other experiences of group, including the protesting radical left within the United States at that time, the Vietnam War, where, God help you if your political thoughts strayed one hair's breadth off of correctness and the radical left point of view. And then I went from that to the slightly drug-addled, saccharine, what Swami used to call, if it moves, hug it, group. And so this was groups. And so my two friends are coming through going, come with us. Come with us to the spiritual community. I said, no, thank you. But off they came. And about a year later, I decided, gosh, maybe time to head back to the States. You are forever a foreigner in Japan and a subject of much curiosity. I was very weary of that, too. So on my way back to Indiana, where my family was, I stopped here. They picked me up in San Francisco, drove me up here into the hills, and I had my first experience of divine friendship, of impersonal love, and of being with people who, and I still visualize it this way, of standing with all of you, gazing up together at the mountaintop, utterly accepting of where each of us is on the side of that mountain, and being there with very short memories about each other's flaws and failings and mistakes, and long, supportive, and loving memories about all the lifetimes we've spent together. So it was a marvelous experience. I'm not even sure who I met that time, although I do remember that very lovingly, Prakash taught me energization and Hong Saw in 20 minutes before I had to leave to fly on to Indiana. So it was a very interesting first step. And so from there, I went back to Japan. I finished lots of things up and was able to move here then just in time for SRW 1978. And from SRW 1978, I went right into 2 months of the apprentice program, directed again by Prakash. And of course, I have my own. For those of you who know me, you know that outdoorsy isn't the first word that springs to mind. We used to, in the Sangha office, we worked with Kabir, who was a lovely man. And he was urging that we bond as a working group in the Sangha office by going snow camping. And I urged trips to the Galleria. And we had the two poles. But at any rate, I realized camping was it. There really wasn't that much here. So at Apprentice Village, way above the hill of Apprentice Village, was the tenting area. And I set up my little tent on the first night. And I slept zero, because also it's been mentioning snufflings and shufflings and crunchings outside the tent. Very mysterious beasts. And I was frozen. But I had laid on top of my sleeping bag, and now it's September, because that was the flow of the year then, my crisp sogna whites, because this was what I was sure I should wear to sogna in the morning. And Prakash ran very lovingly, but it was a little bit austere in those days. So the sogna bell was at 5. I was also terrified of missing the bell. So, but I heard the bell. I somehow managed to get into the sogna whites. I began to perceive that somewhere during the night it started raining, the first real rain of the season. What I did not understand at that point, and all of you here now understand, is that lovely powdery red clay with the first rain transmogrifies into sort of a community-wide banana peel. And I came out of my tents in my crisp whites and stood at the top of the hill ready to make my way down. I thought, gosh, I'm a couple minutes late. Oh, no. And I needn't have worried, because I made it to the bottom in record time on one hip. Just boom, right down. And so I was on time for that first sign. But this, too, was just an extraordinary sense of freedom. It was because I did have a thing about creature comforts. From that program, I was able to move over and join my deep, deep, dear Guru Bhais who lived with me in the convent. In those days, I bought Maya Tree's little 14-foot trailer. And there we were, of course, one propane light and no running water. And Maya Tree had installed a wood stove in the 14-foot trailer. And the first night, and now it's November, and it's very cold, and I'm not snowing yet, but very cold. I remember standing in the middle of my trailer, semi-weeping, because I couldn't find wood small enough to go into it. I think the sisters in those days cut, pardon me, 5-quart of wood. We went out as a group and cut and split 5-quart of wood. Wood was there. I couldn't find any to fit in this sort of petite little wood stove that was appropriate to a 14-foot trailer. And so I found everything I could in the trailer, wrapped myself in it, lay down and sort of not cried myself to sleep, but it was close. It was very uncomfortable. Now, many people have wonderful superconscious dreams of the masters and visions. That night, however, I dreamt of and I saw very clearly in my mind's eye exactly how to build a fire in that little stove, how you position the smaller pieces around the larger pieces, the appropriateness of the wood. I was so grateful. It just was a marvelous. It's exactly, God gives you what you need in the moment. It's actually very touching. Remember, Swamiji talks about sometimes if, you know, you feel Divine Mother's guidance or presence pushing you in large directions that have to do with the movement of the work and changing great directions. That's one thing, but the sweetness can often come in the little tiny responses, and that was very much the case. But I wanted to say a few things about Swamiji in this time, because it was a time, I just looked at last night again, a letter that he received in, I think it was 1974. It's in the letters collected under the title In Divine Friendship. But it's from a woman who's a householder with family. And it's basically taking him to task, as people did, for not creating a community that was really friendly to or possible for families to be here. And his response to this woman was so loving, so patient, and asking her to consider it from all angles. But he also said, in this moment, we are in a phase where it's going to take a few people who need to bring to it a willingness to be simply pioneers and live with a great deal of perhaps self-sacrifice. And he said, and of course, that's necessary for any walk of life. But he acknowledged what she was going through. And it was also around that time, as a couple of years later, that, sorry about that, he announced to the community, I think it must have been in January when, I don't want to call them State of the Union addresses, but there would be some gathering, reflecting on the past year and doing some goal setting. And that, I think it was around 1979 or 80 in January when he suggested that we set a goal as a community to have all of our businesses together generate $1 million. And great, there was a great intake of breath. And the Thursday night, I couldn't, at the wonderful launch for this next phase of the building temple and the miraculous gift through Jairam and Michael and Catherine, it was, somehow those parallels came right into my mind of this stunning gift for $1 million. But just everything, we were in a phase then trying to recall, okay, what were those big rivers of energy in 1978, 79, and 80? And it was to raise our energy, to understand that the beauty, the simplicity, the refinement in our environment was something that we needed to embrace as yogis and feel that it was ours and raise our energy so that everything about Ananda was a reflection of our spiritual aspirations.
So that particular date for me that I'll always remember was March 15th, 1978, and I was in Houston, Texas at the time, and Swami Kriyananda, and he was on what is called the Joy Tours, and he had taken an entourage of people and traveled around the United States and the northern continent, and spoke at a yoga studio I was attending. It's interesting. I wasn't sure what the date was, so I got on my Outlook calendar and I just kept hitting the back button all the way to what I thought was the date. And it was a Wednesday, March 15th, 1978. And it set it as an appointment. It said, 2,050 weeks overdue. So I know it was 2,050 weeks ago. Interesting. So anyway, I was confirmed because Treasures Along the Path found a talk of that evening, and it was that night. And so I listened to it. Now, how rare is that? I could actually know the exact date I met Swami and had the talk from that evening. So I listened to it with great anticipation. We could listen to that right now, and it would be as pertinent now as it was then. So the vision was always before him, and we just had to come, and no matter what time we got here, what year, it was always before us to expand this work, increase our understanding of Yogananda and Swamiji's expression of truth, the teachings, and get more in tune and serve. It's always been that way. It is that way now. So when I came, I did have a car, and I drove here, and it was the first apprenticeship program of the winter. It was always in the summer, and they thought, well, we need to expand this so that people can come anytime. So they didn't really think it through, because I... first of all, having met Swami, I stayed in Houston for another 6 months and helped start an ashram. Swami came there a couple of times, and I got to drive him around, and I felt really blessed to be able to be with him on those occasions before I even came. So when I did arrive, and I was ready for my Kriya in August of 1978 at Spiritual New Week, and then at that time there was a kind of a meeting with the ashram leaders in Houston, and they decided they were going to fold the ashram. And I thought, oh no, now what am I going to do? Because everyone I had met at the village, they were saints. And I certainly wasn't a saint, and there was no way I could live here. I wasn't ready. And so that's how I felt. But I think Swami picked up on that, and he told Asha, because I when it was decided, I was crestfallen. I walked away from that meeting. We had a dinner meeting at the end of Spiritual Week, and I was walking away very depressed, you know. And thinking, where am I going to go now? I'm not ready for this, and I don't want to go back. There was nothing back in Houston without the ashram. And so Asha came running up to me and he said, Swami told me to tell you that you should move to Ananda, that this is your home. And I needed to hear that. You know, it was so beautiful that he knew that I needed to hear it. So the next day, we always took a picture at the end of Spiritual New Week with everybody, and I sat right next to Swami. I always tried to get as close to him as I could. So I was sitting next to him, and he just looked at me and said, so what do you think? And I said, I'll start packing as soon as I get home. And he said, good. So went back, gave my notice where I was working, and was here a month later for the apprentice program up at the meditation retreat in winter. And all of the buildings up there, there were not many, but all of them were drafty. And so everybody, you got picked up by now that it was cold. So anyway, I finished my apprenticeship program up there, and it was 3 months, and it was Christmas, and I was about to move down to the farm, and there was nothing open, no dwelling, except a tree hut. And I think a series of people lived in that tree hut. I won't call it a tree house because it was only 6 feet by 10 feet, 60 square feet, and it was down at the village, the lowest part. If you're down there at night, you know it's always 10 to 15 degrees colder down there. And I froze that winter. I bought a sleeping bag on my way here in an Army Navy store in Arizona, and it was $25. I thought it's a mummy bag. They're all the same to me. Well, I think it was for soldiers in the tropics because it was filled with chicken feathers, I learned later. So I froze. So I'm going to give you a day in the life. So I slept cold, and I what woke me up was Ananta. He would get down there and fire up the tractor. And when I heard that tractor, I had time to get up. So I would make my way over to the master's market. And in the attic above the market was a little room, and it was a library. And it had this little space heater, you know. So it was an electric space heater. So I would set it at a certain thermostat, you know, because it was very quiet. beautiful, as you know, still to this day, it's so quiet here, so still. So I thought, but I was a hatha yogi, and I want to do some postures, I want to meditate. So I get into the postures, just nice and peaceful, and the heater would come on. It was a bit like hell, yoga, you know, in hell. So then that aspect of it. So then I went through my postures, and I'd sit to meditate, and it would get so cold. And then I'd get quiet, and that heater would come on. So that was the beginning of the day. Then I went to the dairy where I was working, and they and people, I said, well, everything was really just an idyllic, romantic whole, how I met Swami, how I came here. And hey, there was a job open just after I finished my the apprentice program, and it was the dairy. So I got into the dairy, and it was very muddy. Everything was mud then, you know, and it was winter, and it rained all the time. And there was this big moat around the barn, and the cows would get very muddy, and we had to wash them first and then milk them. And my hands were warm. That was the only part of me that was warm. But it was there were a lot of beautiful parts to it. But in the winter, it was very cold. So I get to the dairy, and by the way, it's already been established that it was $50 a month. But there was community dues, which was waived because that was a job that didn't generate a lot of money, the department. So it was dues covered, $50 a month, and all the dairy products you could eat. And it wasn't until the spring that we were able to trade with the garden and get some veggies and maybe some strawberries. But otherwise, it was pretty, you know, dairy in the winter. You didn't have any granola. Yeah. But it was austere. That was our tapasya time, you know. So I'd be milking this cow, and I'd never, and those that know me, I'm very fastidious. I'm very clean. And, in Houston, my room was like a whole wool carpet. I had a glass altar, a glass pyramid for my stereo. Everything was like OCD clean. So I get here, and I'm in the dairy, like in the mud, milking this cow. And I have my face up against the cow. And the tail is dragging through the mud and the manure. So tails, they swish the tail, right? So the tail comes around, comes across, slaps me in the face, and puts the little point of the tail right in my mouth. Wow. That's a good story. So what I learned to do is you take that tail and you put it behind your knee. And when you're squatting, you have that tail locked. And, but the cow is instinct to move the tail, so you're moving your legs. You know, as the tail's trying to swat the flies, you know. So anyway, that was incredible. I get, you know, everybody probably takes so much more time. I want to just do some snippets like, okay, so you're dirty. Laundry service. There were no laundromats here or washers and dryers. So every now and then an enterprising young soul would, hey, I'm going to start a business. I'm going to get all the laundry and take it to town to that place that Hridaya mentioned near Swenson's and do everybody's laundry. Well, nobody had that many clothes, so they had to combine them in loads. So you'd get your laundry back and... you know, I had somebody else's underwear that was like this big. It wasn't mine. And then my shirt, one of my favorite shirts, is not in it. So I'm looking around. So you walk around the committee looking at other people to see if they had your shirt on, you know. Hey, that's my shirt. I don't know. It was in my bag, you know. So anyway, that's how we got our clothes done. I did get a cabin after the triad. It was beautiful. A guy named Shiva built it. I think Parvati came with somebody named Shiva. They built a cabin. It was 10 by 10 and it had a loft. Beautiful. It was warm, you know. So it was up, but no utilities, kerosene lantern. And I had to lug the water up there. And in the winter, you couldn't get the car up there. Too muddy of a road. So I would walk 50. I had 2 5-gallon jugs. I'd walk 50 yards, put it down. Walk 50 yards to put it down to get 10 gallons of water up there in the winter. So water was like gold, you know. You wash your teeth, like, that's it. You know, not very, very sparse. So I want to get to you know, I was meditating, and there were, and as it got warmer with the stove that I have on, there were some wasps flying around, you know, so I opened the window in the loft and I shoot out the wasps. Okay, this is great. Okay, I got rid of them. So I'm hearing a buzz, you know, I think, hey, maybe I'm hearing the second chakra. But it was coming from the wall. So burlap was the cloth at the time for, you know, for things. I moved the burlap. There was a swath of these wasps that wide, this long, and that thick. I kid you not. I just put the burlap back and go away. So I live with these wasps the whole entire time, and they were very actually friendly creatures if you don't sit on them or accidentally, you know, touch them. Otherwise, they didn't bite at all. They'd land on my book and walk across and fly away. So anyway, but I want to get to one inspiring story, Swami Kriyananda, which was why I came. In those days, you know, Ananda was sort of shifting a bit. I did come after the fire, so it was very primitive. I know that they had built 20 houses, but they were gone when I came, and there was a lot of rusty farm equipment and, you know, charred remains and so on. So it was back to the beginning in some ways. This wasn't here. We all, like they said, we'd gone up to the retreat for our Sunday service, and Swami led things, and it was very, in his vision, it was everything. And it wasn't until somebody visited that you wanted to show them around here. There's nothing to show them physically. It was all energy and spirit, you know. But so Swami had a dome, and I started working in Ananda recordings with Anandi and Ganesha and Jeannie and Nirmala, and we were a team. And I got to be Swami's recording engineer, which is a trumped-up term because I wasn't an engineer at all. I just had a big stereo, you know, went before I came, and I knew how to do the controls. But anyway, this very moving story. I'm going to set it again so I know how much I go over. So Swami, he took a lot of photographs in those days, and he wanted to do some slideshows. I think this was a. Was that one about people? Different worlds. So, but he didn't have any of his own music except chants and things like that. He didn't have all the instrumentals like Quest for Joy, you know, IOMR, and Secrets of Love. So he had to depend on some other pieces. So this is the time, signs of the times, right? He had a record player, and he had these vinyl albums, and we're sitting there, just he and I. It was a day I'll never forget, and there were many like that, but this one I always remembered. And he would pick up an album, and he would study it a bit, and I would just sit very still, and he'd pull it out and hand me the album, and I'd put it on the record player, and I would very carefully, he'd say track 3, and I'd very carefully put it on the space between the pieces, you know, and then he'd listen to it. We'd listen to it together in silence. And then he'd say, okay, good. And then he'd pick up another one. I'd take it off. But it was beautiful music, classical music, Bach and Mozart and so on. And I'll never forget. So the energy was building, and it was very moving and a lot of heart. And Swami picked up this one, and it was St. Matthew's Passion. And I put it on. And I was, you know, resonant with Swami there. In that experience, and I put on St. Matthew's Passion, and he just began to weep, and I wept, and it was so beautiful, and that's the way he was. It was whatever, in any moment, whatever the energy was, he expressed it, and it was so moving and so much heart, and then weeped a bit, and then the weeping stopped. He said, "Got another one? We put this on." And we moved on to the next piece. But those times with him in that, over at the dome, and then when the money came from his inheritance and we built the recording studio, there were many more occasions like that, recording Swami, because he got off and running, because he had his own studio then and had our own vibration, and he was just creating one thing after the other. And it was a beautiful time.
First of all, I want to thank each of the speakers. Everyone was so inspiring, and you know, next to having Master and Swami in our lives, sharing the lives with Guru Bhais like all of you is such an incredible blessing. You know, if you, my job is to sort of sum up. And when you look at the common themes, cold, mud, inadequate housing, but behind it all, and this is the lesson that never stops, is the nothingness. Not to be afraid of the nothingness. Not to be afraid to go where you've never gone before. Whether it's coming from Japan or Dallas or Austin or Molina, Illinois or St. Louis, Missouri. Don't be afraid. Whether you've, this is your first day at Ananda, embrace the nothingness. Because it's only out of the silence comes the song of creation. Out of the darkness comes the light. And when we share these funny stories about the nothingness, it takes faith and courage and determination and inner strength to live in the nothingness. I shared so many of the experiences. I think Krishnadas inherited the tree hut. I lived there too when I first came. My first home, as Swami sings about, was a green hill. Put a sleeping bag out on a hillside. Then I graduated to the tree house and on. I lived in a teepee for a while, had the same experience as Catherine where I didn't know how to build a fire, fell asleep weeping with the cold. Exactly. I'll tell one funny story about when I was in the trailer, I mean in the teepee, I had, you know, it has these wonderful little lodgepole pines that many of us were involved with cutting down and stripping to create the teepees, and Sadhana Devi sewed the canvas skins for them. But at the top of my poles, I strung little strips of cloth with little bells on them, so it was like a wind chime. When the wind blew, it was nice. And again, it was the nothingness. You know, I lived alone in this little teepee. No one else was very close. No water, no outhouse, no heat. But one morning, I was reading this beautiful book about St. Francis by Kazantzakis, Nicholas Kazantzakis, simply called St. Francis. And so I was reading it. And one morning I woke up, I meditated, and it had been raining. And I looked out, lifted the little flap of the teepee, and the mountains were just blanketed with mist. And I picked up the book, and the first sentence was, "The mountains were blanketed with mist." And I thought, that's kind of odd. It was a little bit like the never-ending story, if you know that book. And then the wind started coming up, and the next sentence was, "St. Francis heard the wind blowing in the trees." That's kind of weird. And then the bells on the little cloth started ringing. And the next sentence was, "In the distance, St. Francis heard the bells." And I thought, oh, my God, this is getting scary. And then the next sentence was, "It indicated the approach of the lepers." I stopped reading at that point. I didn't mind the void, but I wasn't ready for the lepers. But we all could share hundreds of stories like that. And it could be, you know, if we were ever write another book, Stories of Ananda, Early Years of Living in the Void. But what filled the void for all of us, and this was one of the underlying themes that everybody said, it wasn't a void because of the grace of God and Guru. And I loved what Sudarshan said about feeling that wind. I felt that wind, too, the first day I set foot on this property. And that was July 4th, 1969. So I'm coming up to 48-year anniversary. And I just stepped on the property into the void, and I felt the wind. And the wind was, home is a green hill, home is a wind. You know, that's was our home. nothing. But there was Swami saying, how do you like it? You can have Kriya. Sit and listen to this music with me. Type up this book. Lead the community. All the things he gave us to do to make us feel we had value. And so that's the beauty of the spiritual life. In the world, we learn that our value comes from putting things on, degrees and jobs and wealth and cars and clothes and whatever it is. We put all these things on the outside. You come to the spiritual life, you come to Ananda, and you enter the void. And all those things get taken away, and there's nothing of value. Who cares that you had a job? Who cares, you know, your clothes are taken away, everything's taken away. But what Swami filled the void with was the sense that our value only lay in the fact that we were a part of God, and nothing else mattered. And we began to believe in that ourselves as we were willing. And I invite, if you just came today, be willing to have it all stripped away and say, my only value is that God loves me. And if we can all, that's really the message of Ananda. God loves us, and we need to help other people remember that he loves them too. And that's what Swami gave us.